The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of year where I am stuck inside with the kids on February vacation. Someone's got to do it. And it looks like it's me. Meanwhile, Michael, I don't know where Michael went, but apparently he needed extra days for his vacation. Where did Michael go?
I actually didn't listen when he said.
That's the way Matt gets along with everybody.
I'm going to Paris. That's all I know.
Matt is in Paris as we speak. I mean, not as we speak, as you hear it. So what are you doing? Are you just getting high and playing video games there?
No, I don't think I'll be able to do either of those things there.
I would be willing to bet things. That you'll be able to do both, frankly.
We'll see.
Check Matt out on Twitter. He's in Paris right now. It's Wednesday, so you've been there for what, 3 or 4 days?
Yeah, actually, I'll just be about to come back.
Wow. Well, that's very nice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're on vacation, yet we still provide for you brand new content. We've had an amazing week so far. Today, no difference. Sam Rosenfeld, author of The Polarizers, Post-War Architects of Our Partisan Era, and fascinating book by a very smart associate professor, assistant professor, and it's interesting to get a perspective as to how we got here. And there was a time where, you know, and look, I think Rosenfeld says this, I certainly don't have a particular issue with our polarization. I don't, broader process questions are not, don't keep me up at night. But it seems to me inevitable that you're going to have polarization when you have differences of opinion politically. The extent of the polarization and the grounds for it, though, sometimes are a little bit suspect. But I think you'll find it's very interesting. We're going to take a quick break. Matt will have one of his famous I'm in Paris picks for the fun half. Who knows what it'll be? Something Parisian, maybe? We don't know. But fun half, folks, members. And I want to thank our members. It is you that make this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Please do if you have the financial means. And if you don't, as always, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will take care of you. We will not lock anybody out for financial reasons. All right, quick break. When we come back, Sam Rosenfeld. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sam Rosenfeld. He's an assistant professor of political science at Colgate University and author of The Polarizers, Post-War Architects of Our Partisan Era. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Okay, so the your book tracks, I guess, our how we got to where we are today. And it starts in the post-war period, where the problem at that time, and I'm not necessarily saying that the problem today is polarization, but the I guess the conventional wisdom, or maybe the conventional wisdom of the political science community, was that there was not enough partisanship.
Exactly. Yeah, I would say it was a live debate, but that leading scholars of parties and political science, as well as journalists and sympathetic political activists and politicians in the early post-war era, sort of diagnosed as a crucial problem in the American political system as it evolved, a kind of, insufficient amount of polarization, to use that term.
And what, I mean, what was the, if that's the diagnosis, what was the, I guess, the prognosis? I mean, maybe vice versa. What was the problem? What problems was too much bipartisanship causing at that time?
Sure. So if you think back to this era, you're talking about two major parties that were quite internally, ideologically heterogeneous or divided internally. So you had within the Democratic Party that since the New Deal had emerged as a kind of national, the national center-left party, had this quite empowered and quite increasingly conservative, dominated by Southerners faction that was empowered in Congress, that was, filled with segregationist white supremacists. And a lot of those people were also kind of ideologically conservative on other issues. You had in the Republican Party a kind of core of conservatives, but also particularly people who held kind of governorships in large industrial states. You had a kind of a tradition of more moderate and liberal Republicans as well. What these scholars and thinkers thought about a system that had parties like that is that, even leaving substantive sort of policy aside, it posed a democratic, small d democratic problem to have two parties that were not providing voters distinct choices at the during elections. Voters didn't have a strong sense as to like different directions the country would go into for voting for one politician versus another. And then on top of that, the kind of rampant degree of bipartisan lawmaking that happened in the system at that time meant that come re-election time, voters didn't have any real sense of who to hold accountable for outcomes, for the state of the country, for policies that are passed, because both sides were collaborating so much in policymaking. And you'd have basically ad hoc bipartisan coalitions sort of collaborating issue by issue. So it became very unclear, again, who you were holding accountable, where the lines of responsibility in public policy were. That was the kind of high-minded political science democratic theory critique. The other reality is, a lot of these political scientists, not all of them, but many of them were themselves kind of liberal Democrats interested in seeing the promise of the New Deal and a kind of social democratic direction for national policy thrive and continue. And they saw as a chief problem this kind of dissident faction within their own associated political party that was empowered to kind of bottleneck progress and collaborate with a minority party to block things from happening.
Okay, so I mean, what you've described there is one is an intellectual movement, if you will, that was running in parallel with the desire of at least one party's activists. Let's stay
right
with that. Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves at that point, but what was, if it was the case that you had Democrats who ranged from, I guess, very pro-labor, liberal Democrats, Northern Democrats, industrial Democrats, and conservative, at least in terms of aggressively in terms of race, it sounds like, and perhaps anti-union in the South. I mean,
yes, definitely.
And then in the Republican Party, you had a similar, maybe the numbers were slightly reversed, but a similar dynamic. What was What held the parties together? Was it just simply tradition? My dad was a Democrat, so I'm going to be a Democrat, regardless of whether or not there's some type of ideological sorting? Or what was it that was? Was it just like, oh, I ended up going to Pepsi instead of Coke because I was recruited out of college? You know,
right.
I mean, is that basically what was going on?
I mean, that's a great question. I think one of the answers is that the American political system, the constitutional structure, has always allowed for the parties to sustain much higher levels of internal diversity than in other countries, particularly federalism and separation of power, so that you could be affiliated with a party with a specific kind of constituency. If you were a local Democrat in a big city and part of a machine, or a Southern congressman who would be voted over and over again back into office by constituents who would increasingly over the course of the 20th century vote for a Republican for a president, all the kind of multifaceted, fragmented, multiple levels of the American government allowed for different people, ostensibly paying fealty to the same party to stand for different things to different voters at different times, which is something you don't see in other non-federal parliamentary systems, for example. But then also it is, the inheritance of party affiliations from history matters a lot. It was very sticky. It was sticky on the level of who ordinary voters voted for. You know, my granddaddy was a Democrat. My daddy was a Democrat. I'm a Democrat. That kind of inherited team or church-like affiliation that didn't really have much to do with policy issues or ideology. And, you know, if you could look back to the 19th century as a good example of a time when the party system was stronger than it's ever been. Really defined political life and mobilized huge numbers of voters in a pre-electronic age. And they were not, most of the time, at the national level, ideologically defined at all. What motivated parties then was kind of the material incentives of patronage. That's what would motivate a lot of people to participate in politics. The policies that were being passed at the national level had more to do with just kind of distributing goodies to one party network or another rather than big ideological battles over redistribution or regulation. And, you know, through the 20th century, you have some of those motivations, particularly in the over time dwindling number of urban political machines and rural political machines, for that matter, that, again, organize party loyalties and activism, but were not preoccupied in any way by national issues or national ideologies. So go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, is that, I mean, because, I mean, in around that time, I guess maybe 20s, 30s, you had a sort of a good governance movement that began to attack those sort of entrenched political boss type of systems on a local level. But I think the other thing that occurs to me is that as you move into the post-war period, the policies of the federal government become more important. Right. I mean, because we're following the New Deal and everything that is involved in that. And we talk about sort of national housing policy. We talk about a national health insurance policy. And we've just introduced a national, retirement insurance policy. And so these issues become so coherence, ideological coherence becomes more important because there is a centralizing of policy apparatus. So go ahead.
That is absolutely right. That is exactly what these scholars were saying too. A lot of whom, had just came out of service in World War II as technical experts and advisors, et cetera. Everyone got mobilized for that experience. The argument, as you point out, the progressive era in the early 20th century sort of ushered in a set of institutional attacks on those old non-ideological patronage-based party organizations and other kinds of kind of technocratic reforms. But then it's the New Deal as a sort of revolution in American policy that brings to the forefront for the first time a very activist, visible national government and national policies that are going to now shape political battles that only gets aggravated even more as a result of participation in the biggest, you know, global conflagration in world history, in which the United States emerges out of that as a global leader. What these guys say is politics at the national level needs to be about national issues, and national issues are more important than they've ever been before. So what we need are parties that can help to shape national debates and competition over the direction of national policy.
And so you're going from a political units, if you will, that are more transactional because they are more parochial, to political parties that are ideological, so that that policies can be implemented on a broader scale.
Exactly, and what starts to happen, and commentators take note of this, is you know, over the long term of a decline in the old style political machines and the spread of mass education, you get a new kind of political activism. I mean, it's not something new under the sun, but the rise to predominance of activism within parties by people who are motivated by issues or ideology. And they are typically, increasingly in the post-war era, motivated in interested in national level issues. Some of the policies you just said, civil rights, healthcare, labor law, et cetera. And in local and state parties in states all across the country, during the 1950s, 40s and 50s, you start to see the emergence of kind of internal party battles between old line party functionaries who aren't particularly interested in these ideological or issues at all, and these new activists seeking to reform their parties and ultimately take control over them. And that happens in both parties.
Does it happen more within the Democratic Party than the Republican Party? Because it seems to me that you're moving, you know, once we go into the New Deal, right, there's a certain trajectory there which is going to require the nationalization of politics more, and therefore the ideologicalization, I don't think that's a word, but of political parties, and that it would make sense, just based on their very nature, that Democrats would be more aggressive in trying to push that, I guess, you know, not just within the form follows the function in terms of,
right,
for Democrats more so than for Republicans. And yet we're also at a time then where there's seemingly, and Kennedy, I guess, says this in during his presidency, we're not having an argument about outcomes. We're just having an argument about how to get there, more or less. I think I'm paraphrasing, but
right.
And so those two things are in tension with each other, or where do those two concepts stand within each party and across party lines?
Well, on the question of, you know, who's doing this when, I think it's definitely the case that it's obviously the New Deal project is not just a partisan project, but it is Roosevelt and was a Democrat, and his majorities were Democrats. And precisely because what the advocates for what they called responsible party government, this idea of more disciplined and distinct and issue-driven parties at the national level, programmatic parties, they would call it, you know, what they had in mind was the Labour Party in Great Britain, which, you know, right after the war runs an election in which they have a whole manifesto laying out their plans to nationalize industries, implement a universal healthcare system, et cetera, and they get elected and they are able to do all of that. Whereas, you know, Harry Truman's running into a bunch of trouble trying to pursue a fair deal agenda at the exact same time. What they wanted were kind of parliamentary style parties that at the national level could do more stuff. And that is a institutional, as you said, form follows function. That's an institutional critique and goal that is more amenable, I think, to big government activists, you know,
right,
people who want to use national power to do things. So you don't get, so the political science critique of the existing political system is, I think, resonates more with liberal activists, Democratic politicians, people like Hubert Humphrey, who meets with all the political scientists who are talking about this. He had a master's in political science himself. He gives speeches about it. I talk about a Democratic National Committee chair in the late 1950s, Paul Butler, who, you know, gives speeches explicitly kind of touting this and pursues reforms that were prescribed by some of these political scientists. Conservatives have, it's a different trajectory in which, you know, the institutional critique remains much more about protecting the prerogatives of Congress, and obviously states' rights becomes more and more of a catch-all when it comes not only to civil rights, but other kinds of national activism. And yet, some of the same factional divisions and the dynamics of those divisions crop up on the Democrat, on the Republican side. First, you get battles between supporters of Robert Taft for president and the kind of activists aligned with him against several liberal to moderate presidential candidates in a row, culminating in Eisenhower. Then you get, on the one hand, the kind of intellectual mission statements coming out of the conservative intellectual movement of William F. Buckley and the National Review, which is emerging by the middle of the 1950s. And at the grassroots level, this same kind of predominantly middle-class, well-educated, increasingly suburban cohort of grassroots activists who are challenging existing state and local party organizations and who provide the kind of backdrop for and the troops for the Goldwater insurgency that takes over the Republican Party in 1964, which is all about injecting stark, you know, offering a choice rather than an echo, as Phyllis Schlafly put it, campaigning for him.
I mean, is that choice? From the Republicans' perspective in that era, and I think I would argue that it's continued on. We've sort of lost sight
sure.
of this, but I feel like that was there any more explicitness to, like, look, we are federalizing things too much. I mean, the irony is that the activists on the Democratic side want to federalize things more, and one would think on the Republican side you'd want that they want that less, and so the ideological divide is that primary divide right there, and it hasn't yet taken shape. Maybe it does with Goldwater, but it hasn't quite taken shape in the form of sort of the second order issues that follow. Does that make sense?
So are you saying were conservatives aware that trying to nationalize party debates would have the effect of empowering the national government in a way
yeah,
they wouldn't like?
Yeah, right. I mean, for Democrats at that point, it seems to me the question is like, what's the best way to for the government to provide health care? And
right.
And for Republicans at that stage, it's still like, no, that the federal government should not be providing health care. I mean, how much?
Right.
And they weren't quite there yet with sort of having to pretend that the second order question was relevant.
I would say, I mean, partly they you can't discount the degree to which both liberals and conservatives had a belief that there was a electoral majority in the country that supported their position, and that American political institutions and the interacting with the parties were serving to kind of prevent or obscure or bottle up this latent majority out there that would, from Democrats' perspective, champion the kind of continual expansion of the American government into a robust social democracy. Or on the flip side, you know, what conservative activists, you know, what they were doing was trying to put together a national Republican coalition by going after the South. And this is something, you know, people talk about Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, but for two decades before that, there are efforts to, whether it's a kind of a new party venture or trying to find ways to kind of forge a formal alliance of Southern Democrats, have them switch party affiliation in Congress to Republicans. There are all these efforts to try and achieve a kind of national conservative party that it could finally absorb formally the dissident conservative faction in the Democratic Party. So they're interested in nationalizing their party in that regard. But a lot of them, I don't think, made the connection between essentially nationalizing American parties and partisan conflict with necessarily ending up turning the national government into this activist state. I think they thought they'd have the political support to pursue conservative ends with national power.
So at what point and tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems at one point, and I don't know when it took place, whether it was in the 70s or probably the 80s, this flipped, it seems, that the push for polarization, the ballast seems to move from the Democrats to the Republicans. Is that accurate? And if so, when did that happen?
I think so. Yeah, I would say, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here, because there is I think a conventional wisdom in scholarship that I agree with, that what's called asymmetric polarization. Now, when we talk about polarization in a contemporary era, we are not talking about equal, both sides are moving to extremes or sort of pursuing the same tactics, but instead this is primarily a Republican story with sort of byproducts that we can look at and say it's polarization, but it's being driven by that side. Part of what I'm trying to do with this book is, both point to and champion to a certain extent, just to show my normative priors a little bit, the contributions that Democrats made to reconstructing partisan and political institutions in ways that made them more permeable to issue-driven and ideological activism, which I don't think is a bad thing, but that did have contributions to long-run polarization. In the 1970s, you have it's a kind of free-for-all. The parties disintegrating before everybody's eyes. All political scientists are mainly then talking about things like de-alignment and the declining significance of parties, the decline of American political parties. It's a time of huge institutional reforms. You get the McGovern-Fraser Commission that leads to the rise of primaries. You get congressional reforms that really topple the power of these congressional committees and the power of seniority in determining clout in Congress, and instead empowers party leaderships. You have the kind of second wave of potent grassroots conservative mobilization, particularly on the side of the kind of new right activists that are marrying economic conservative pro-business activism with these new cultural and social issues, bringing in the religious right into the fold. And you get it's definitely true if you look at measures of polarization in voting behavior in Congress, et cetera. It's a story from the late 1970s onward of a continual push on the right to both on the policy agenda and on sort of changing political institutions, making the party in Congress under Newt Gingrich especially ever more of a kind of aggressive, highly centralized partisan machine, that you see that energy and those that kind of push much more on the right than you do on a left that has kind of attempted to stitch together, and more successfully, I think, than a lot of people give them credit for, a coalition that is a little bit less ideologically cohesive than the Republicans, but certainly way more ideologically cohesive than the Democratic Party used to be, and are sort of in a defensive position for the next several decades politically.
I mean, is the because I get, you know, when we go through the 70s and you talk about the party reforms, like the process reforms and the sort of like the big D Democratic changes in the way that the party runs itself, it seems like ideologically, you know, it's not. Ideologically speaking, there's not necessarily the big changes that take place through the 70s and the 80s. And to the extent that there are any ideological changes, it seems to me to move towards the center. And on the right, it's happening the opposite way. It is far more right. ideological, and it is tracking much further away from the center. I mean, by the time we get to Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton is sounding more like Reagan, right? I mean, whereas Reagan is actively attacking liberals and Democrats, Bill Clinton is at least agreeing in some principle with Reagan that government, the era of big government is over and whatnot, right? I mean, that's a tack right. to the right from where maybe Democrats were 20 years earlier, it seems to me, or 25 years earlier. So there's like a stag. If anything, there's a stagnation in terms of like the ideological right. polarization from the center. I mean, as measured from the mean, I guess, of where the party was, and it's the opposite for the right.
Well, here's where the kind of new Democratic factional push in the 80s and 90s is an important development, and one that, you know, pushes against even the narrative I'm telling of polarization. What I would say, though, is as you just mentioned, the mean kind of ideological degree of liberalism of your average Democrat is over those two decades not, in fact, going to the right. Sort of quantitative political science confirms that you get a rush to the right on the Republican side, and certainly there are issues that emerge, often kind of bipartisan points of corrupt consensus, like around financial reforms and deregulation in the 1990s that reflect not-so-liberal ideological priors. But in general, the party, the base of the party, thanks in part to the activism of people in the 1970s, remains a kind of cultural and economically liberal and increasingly ethnically diverse liberal base. You get at the elite level, and certainly given his victory in winning the nomination in 92, you get a kind of internal argument that is couched in terms of we keep losing the presidency, we need a course correction to try and win some national level elections. That's the kind of pitch that the DLC and New Democrats make, right. As reflected in Bill Clinton. That you know, the points I make in the book is that even that argument and the policies that get produced out of that tendency still stand. They are not what the Southern Democrats and other dissident Democrats argued for in terms of a political posture a few decades before, not just in terms of not being white supremacists, but they were still avowedly partisan And they were still policies that were framed and advocated as to the left of Republicans' policies. And there was also, you know, it was a selective set of policy course corrections. It remained the case that the first big thing that Bill Clinton as president attempted to do was pass a universal health care bill. His record, I think, is mixed in its ideological coloring, but sort of compares from a liberal perspective favorably to Jimmy Carter's presidency. And in the long run, what I think you've seen in the aftermath of the Clinton years is a Democratic Party that still, I think, does not behave symmetrically in any way to the Republican Party, but that has over the course of the Bush, Obama, and Trump years continued to move left.
I would agree with that last part in terms of where we have seen Democrats move, particularly in the past 10 years, to the left, undoubtedly. It seems to me that the assessment of the Clinton years has to be one where, you know, it depends on what you're weighting in your determination of
right.
what going to the left means. I mean, and I would say even the same with Jimmy Carter, right, who oversaw a lot of deregulation
right.
and demobilization of unions, among other things. And so it sort of, let's leave that aside rather than try and sort of enter into those waters. I think, you
sure.
know, the bottom line is that clearly during those years, whether the Democrats tacked to the right, you know, of where they were towards the mean, I guess, or to the left, they didn't move much relative to what was happening
right.
in the Republican Party. Okay, so with this, with is it possible to have a government that has become as federalized as ours has? And I would argue by necessity, but of course that's a function of my priors. Is it possible to not have this type of polarization? And maybe I'm, you know, this is a too big of a thing to chew on at simultaneously, but is there any way to tame? I mean, what is the way? Because I for one, I'm perfectly happy with polarization.
Right.
Because I don't think good things happen particularly in this environment with bipartisanship because of those who espouse it, frankly. And there seems to be a growing awareness in the Democratic Party. It's been there in the Republican Party for some time, just from polling, that polarization is necessary. There's less of an appetite for compromise in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party than there was even 5 years ago. Is polarization, I mean, is it possible to have bipartisanship in this era when there seems to be a lot more explicit understanding that, like, we don't share the same desired outcomes?
Right.
I mean, that's the reality, right? Like, there is not a shared desired outcome here that is cuts across both parties.
Yeah, my answer is no, that you can't, that understanding the basis of this era in the middle of the 20th century of unusual bipartisanship and depolarization, which colors a lot of people's experience, you know, journalists and others of a certain age, this was the world in which they came of age. Understanding that the basis of that was this kind of like historically contingent mismatch of people's views about stuff and the ways the parties were organized and the over time increasing just importance of national level issues, you can't wind back the clock or put the genie back in the bottle or like reconstruct political parties to not be organized around issues in the 21st century, it seems to me. And it's, I do think it's precisely the kind of the sorting out of beliefs on substantive issues into these political parties much more cleanly now that then kind of produces a bunch of feedback dynamics that makes tribalism and hostility to the other side and all of those dynamics that are kind of negative byproducts of it that make those very hard to deal with. What I end up saying, to the extent I can gin up any solutions at the end of this book, is more, you know, that we have a political system that, as critics of the advocates of more partisanship and disciplined parties likes to point out in the middle of the 20th century, they were correct in saying that American political institutions, a system in which there's two different branches of Congress, they're elected at different times, and you also have a president who can veto things, you've got a court that can overturn things. There are so many veto points and kind of places where there are obstacles to making policy in our system, putting into that system two political parties that are ideologically disciplined and distinct, kind of parliamentary style parties, and then giving them the ability to control different branches of the government at the same time, which happens a lot, not right now, but as of a year ago, is a recipe for real crisis and gridlock. And if anything, it encourages unreasonable and unrealistic demands because people know that the parties, particularly if they're in the opposition, know that they're not going to be held responsible for bad things that come out of that. And so you've got a mismatch between how our parties work and how our political system is structured. And you can either hope to kind of change the parties somehow, or you can try and incrementally, short of having a constitutional convention and replacing it with a whole new system of government, you can try and incrementally change the political institutions to try and accommodate these parties. So do things like get rid of the filibuster, which again was a agenda item of responsible party advocates from the beginning. Get rid of counter-majoritarian tools and institutions in the system so that parties, when they happen to have unified power, have the ability to do what they want to do and can be cleanly held responsible for whatever those outcomes are. But that's obviously not a solution to polarization. That's reshaping the government to accommodate polarization.
Right. And okay. And so, I agree with that. I think that's a very good point that people should keep in mind is that, we can have a functioning government. Half of us may not like the way it's functioning, but it will function. I mean, and the idea would be, I think too, in this era is to pare back the reliance on norms and make them, make them more, I guess, the elimination of these norms are more sort of democratic in some way, right? Like what exists is going to have been agreed upon by everybody. But it also,
right, yeah.
But it also seems to me that you have to lean into this polarization to get rid of the abuses from polarization, right? Because there has to be some measure of parity when we talk about the negative impact of this polarization, right? Because it seems to me that we have been living through an era where, because of the rate of polarization on the right, or the right, move away from the mean, they have been willing to discard norms at a rate that is far greater than the Democrats. The Democrats have started to get there a little bit, right? Like where they,
right,
where they got rid of the filibuster under the last term of Obama for judicial picks,
yeah,
and executive. They started to get there, but it seems like you have to go further so that the absence of these norms, which protect the rights of the minority party, impacts both parties equally, right? Like
I think
you have to maintain some type of parity, or the negative effects of this impact one party more than the other, and there's no incentive to basically have a truce.
I mean, I think that's right. I think, you know, I hesitate to opine on, I think there's good scholarship on norms as something that, you know, because I've seen people, Julia Azaria, political scientist at Marquette, says she predicts that the effect of the Trump presidency is going to be useful. You're going to get some formalization of what had been norms about things that the executive branch can or can't do, or conflict of interest rules, et cetera. So formalizing some of that stuff, as you say, is democratic rather than relying on the good behavior of kind of political elites. That said, norms, I think, accompany any political system and are important, and the erosion of them is both dangerous and difficult to control. I do think it's I feel comfortable on a show like this, again, showing my priors, to say that I think there's a lot of people who say that they're upset with polarization, but what they're upset with is the substantive agenda as well as the procedural behavior of the Republican Party. And like, I also object to the behavior of Republicans, you know, as a citizen. And it is a manifestation of polarization, but it's not the polarization that I'm worried about. It's the behavior itself.
Right.
And that all you can do is push politicians and the kind of collective team that of politicians and activists that whose agenda you believe in, to act in as effective and tenacious and disciplined a manner to stop the things that you don't like from happening, and try and take power to do things that you like from happening. And that will worsen, quote, polarization, but it will be necessary to save the country.
Sam Rosenfeld, the book is The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
This is excellent. Thanks so much.